Hello, I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for September the 22nd, 2008. On this week's podcast...
I don't think that the GM debate in the year 2000 was handled very well by those who were participating in it at the time.
In a Science Weekly exclusive, Government Minister Dr. Ian Pearson believes GM foods do have a future in Britain. Plus, we come over all showbiz as Katie Tunstall talks climate change ahead of an expedition to the Arctic.
There's definitely this worry that climate change is turning into some sort of new religion, where everybody wants something to kick against, they can all get together and you don't have to have any sort of dogma and Bible involved, and that's easy for us atheists to get involved in.
Someone else who has his eye to the telescope is geologist Matthew Genge. He's right here in the studio and we'll be asking him about his special space dust. And we rev up the latest green machine. Could the Axon car be the future for road transport?
This is a two-cylinder, 500cc petrol engine built in Britain.
How many miles per gallon?
100.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Before any of that, let's not forget our manners and say hello. Yes, we're back in the relative safety of the Science Pod after last week's trip to the BA Festival of Science in Liverpool. It feels like we're on the other side of the world. Come on, keep up. That was another Katie Tunstall lyric. Not that I know who that is. And there'll be plenty more of those sprinkled out throughout the show, just like stardust. In fact, if you spot them, post them on our New Style blog. Also in the studio, the fantastic James Randerson will be chipping in throughout if he thinks of anything half intelligent to say. Hello, James.
Oh, I doubt that very much. Hello.
How did you find Liverpool? Did you survive, clearly?
It was marvellous, yeah. Very good. We went to the Cowan Club and everything.
Excellent. There's no stereotyping of the Liverpoolian accent or anything last week's show, was
no,
there?
No, definitely not.
It's very good.
Absolutely not.
This week's special guest is Matthew Genge from Imperial College London. Matthew, welcome.
Hello.
His research interests include planetary science, I can roughly work out what that means, but meteoritics and terrestrial igneous petrology. Matt, have you just made those up?
No, I didn't really. Meteoritics is almost the same as planetary science. Scientists like having lots of different names for the same thing.
Same thing, for funding reasons.
Yeah, for funding reasons, obviously.
Let's discuss the universe and you. Micrometeorites, how small does a meteorite have to be a micrometeorite?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are people who talk at length about what we call terminology. About less than a millimetre, let's say, for a micrometeorite.
And your research, we talked about space dust in the intros, and we'll come back to that in a moment. I mean, the idea of space dust, cosmic dust, where it comes from. That was your latest paper in geology. But give us a bit of background on your kind of where you started your research. You used to work with the eminent Monica Grady at Natural History Museum at one point.
Yes, Monica was my boss. She ran my day-to-day work. And I used to be a geologist studying volcanoes. And then I went to the Natural History Museum and started studying dust from space, which is a very unusual thing to study. There's not many people in the world who do that.
How do you know a piece of dust is from space as opposed to from your bedroom floor or something?
That's a bit embarrassing, actually. when we collect this dust and we look at it through a microscope, the dust from space is usually black. As simple as that.
And what colour is... I don't want to know.
Dust from the Earth is all sorts of different colours. Obviously, we do other tests on the dust to tell that it's from space, but it just so happens that most of those extraterrestrial dust particles look black down the microscope.
Now, dust is just ground up rocks from space, and it's a large thing to sort of say in just a few words. But where is all this stuff coming from, and how does it get through the atmosphere without burning up?
Well, we know there's three principal sources of cosmic dust. There's asteroids... big lumps of rock in space that run into each other and produce debris, dust-sized debris. There are comets that are icy balls containing dust particles that as they approach the sun, the ice turns to gas and the dust is liberated and travels around the solar system. And then there's even dust that sleets through our solar system from outside, from interstellar space. And we know that those dust particles that encounter the Earth at low speeds can actually survive coming through the atmosphere, survive the heating.
And so how much of that is there in the atmosphere? I mean, is there any in this room right now?
The Earth captures around 10,000 tons of dust each year. That's around 100 billion particles. And if you imagine that happening every single year, it pretty much means that this dust is everywhere. So there will be dust in this room. There may even be extraterrestrial dust on our clothes. It's all around us, and it could come from asteroids, comets, or even from outside our solar system.
A man who's covered in space dust all the time. James, you've got a question.
Another way into this, I suppose, is also to look at material from asteroids. And, of course, we've had the Hayabusa mission, the Japanese mission, to try and return material from there, which doesn't look like it was successful, but there seems to be some question mark about that. But last week there was also talk of another mission called Marco Polo, which isn't funded yet by the European Space Agency, but it might be. And the idea is to send out a spacecraft to an asteroid, pick up 100 grams of rock and bring it back. What would that sort of mission tell us?
You know, we've got over 30,000 meteorites in the collections around the world, but we don't know where the majority of them come from, exactly which asteroids. The value of going into space is we know exactly which asteroid it comes from, and that tells us how far from the sun it probably formed, and that gives us that little extra information about the formation of our solar system.
These missions, actually, James has mentioned Hayabusa already, but there's been others to try and intercept cosmic dust, things like Stardust. We've talked about that before, and that was a fantastic mission which actually collided with a comet and flew another sort of probe into the dust to try and collect some of that stuff, and that stuff came back in this aerogel substance. Now, what's been the analysis on that so far? What have we found out from that?
Well, I was one of the preliminary examination team for Stardust, so I saw some of the first samples that were brought back to the to Earth and given to the UK. In studying the minerals in that, the main things we discovered is that it looks like comets are not that different from asteroids, and that was a bit of a surprise. Probably the biggest discovery was that comets, which form a long way from the sun in the outer solar system, mainly composed of ice, contain these very high temperature grains that require temperatures of maybe a 2,000 degrees centigrade to form. And those are most likely to have formed in the innermost solar system close to the sun. So we've got to have some way of throwing things from the inner solar system all the way out. So you can imagine our solar system mixing all the time as it was forming. And that makes it much more of a challenge to explain this unusual difference that we see in the composition and nature of the planets.
Can you explain that, though? I mean, these high-temperature grains, well, they were a bit of a surprise when you found them.
They were a surprise, but there was a theory that kind of fits it. There is a theory called the X-wind theory.
I like the name.
A great name, isn't it? And basically, when you have a big star, a young star like our sun, it's magnetic. Big magnetic field, but it's got a disk of dust around it, and it heats up the dust and turns it into a plasma, into a charged gas, and that has a magnetic field too. And if you ever take two magnets and put them up against each other, there's quite a bit of force there and interaction, and it develops a magnetic wind that streams up off of the inside of the disk, and the idea is that wind picks up tiny dust particles and then scatters them over the surface of this accretion disk of the solar system, and can take grains from right close to the sun and drop them all the way out beyond Neptune's current location.
Okay, well, we'll ask you more about the problem of asteroids and potentially even stopping them later in the programme. Thanks for now, Matt. Government ministers have given their strongest backing yet that GM crops could soon be planted in Britain. Science Minister Dr. Ian Pearson has predicted the public will accept the technology if they can be convinced it will provide benefits for consumers. The backlash against GM began in the late 90s, when activists ripped up the plants as trials were conducted. In 2004, the policy director of the Soil Association declared the end of GM in Britain after the government announced that no more GM crops would be grown for the foreseeable future. The technology is widely used already in North and South America and in China. Dr. Pearson, who only moved into his role as Minister of State for Science and Innovation last year, has spoken exclusively to Science Weekly.
I don't think that the GM debate in the year 2000 was handled very well by those who were participating in it at the time.
Do you think it's salvageable? I mean, can you see a future in which GM research carries on sort of unfettered here without people pulling up plants and where we grow GM crops like much of the rest of the world does?
Well, as John Bennington, our chief scientific advisor, has said, GM is one of a number of technologies that we need to be considering if we're going to see advances in, you know, a range of areas, but certainly in plant technologies. And we shouldn't be foreclosing those options that can produce major benefits. If we can produce drought-resistant crops, salt-resistant crops, these could have huge potential benefits for people in developing countries. And I think that we should be allowed to do the research. That's what's, I think, the sort of the key thing to stress as part of the GM debate. It's, in many ways, it's the same as the stem cell debate as well. You need to continue to pursue promising areas of research. When it comes to commercial exploitation, then there are separate set of issues that need to be discussed, and we need to have a genuine debate about public acceptability. And you know, I realise there are people who do have fears and concerns about GM as a technology.
But what do you think it would take for public opinion to shift in the way that, you know, would need to happen for this to happen?
Well, I think that the public want to see benefits from GM technology for the consumer, not just for the fertiliser company or the farmer. And if GM can demonstrably provide, you know, benefits for people living in sub-Saharan Africa because you can have drought-resistant crops, then I think the public will want to support those as products and want to see them commercialised. But that's what we have to do. We have to show that there are benefits to the consumer of adopting GM technologies.
And if it was possible to frame the debate in that way and to communicate that effectively, can you see, you know, public opinion changing in that way and us having, you know, GM crops?
Yeah. If consumers see benefits from GM, then I think a significant majority of them will want to choose GM. But it will be up to industry and up to researchers to prove that these benefits actually exist. And if you go and talk to the experts at the John Innes Centre, for instance, they will tell you about exciting lines of inquiry that they're pursuing that are likely to produce a new generation of crops that will have lots of benefits for consumers, whether they be particularly in the developing world, but potentially elsewhere as well. You know, we need to support that research if it is going to provide, you know, big benefits for consumers right, you know, across the globe.
James Randerson there, speaking to Science Minister Dr. Ian Pearson. James, the government's been sort of ramping up rhetoric on this area for some time now. So take us through what other ministers have been saying and what their plans are.
Well, about a year ago, you wrote a story actually about you know, senior government sources saying that they saw a return for GM and that they wanted to press on this issue. But of course, at that stage, they weren't prepared to kind of come out in the open and say it. And then a couple of weeks ago, Phil Woolis was on Farming Today, and he's one of the environment ministers, and he was saying that those who are anti-GM now have a year to prove what the problems are. That was the way he sort of framed it. So I think it's, you know, these comments from Pearson appear to be suggesting that, you know, they want to make a big effort to convince the public. And he was kind of laying out what the debate would have to be in order to convince people.
Do you get much sense that the government's been talking to industry sort of secretly for a long time to sort of prepare them for the next sort of round of GM debates?
Certainly. The industry does have the ear of government on this issue. Now, whether there's a kind of formal plan with industry, I don't think anyone really knows. But certainly, you know, the industry have been lobbying to try and change the kind of state of play here for some time.
The former chief scientist David King has famously said that, he blames people like the Soil Association who are anti-GM for killing millions of people in Africa. He thinks that GM is one of the technologies that's going to feed the world. Matt, what do you think? Do you think the claims made by GM companies and GM technologists is overblown, or do you think that the other side of the debate is kind of more sort of is in the wrong?
Well, as a non-biologist, as a planetary scientist, my view is there is an inherent risk here because those GM crops will inevitably be released into the wild. You know, as soon as you commercially exploit them, it's inevitable that those materials will escape those fields and will enter the ecosystem. So there is a risk, but there is huge benefits as well. And it's like everything, we've got to balance the benefits against the risk. And we are in a world with a massive food shortage, and it's probably inevitable that GM crops are going to be used worldwide.
Tell us anything you want about this subject on the New Science blog. That's guardian.co.uk/science/blog. Still ahead on this week's programme, a supercharged eco-mobile and...
Hi, this is Katie Tunstall, and this is probably the only time I will ever say you're listening to the Science Podcast from guardian.co.uk. Well, the exciting thing is that we're going to Disco Bay with a beatboxer, which is brilliant. So hopefully he's going to be doing covers of ABBA.
Now, for some of the other stories making headlines this week, James and producer Andy, from now on known as the Chuckle Brothers of Science, take it away.
News Jack.
Britain's National Academy of Science has parted company with its Director of Education after a row over the teaching of creationism in schools. Professor Rice, a Professor of Education at the Institute of Education in London and an ordained Church of England clergyman, agreed to step down from the Royal Society after it claimed he'd unintentionally caused damage to the organisation's reputation. Rice was widely reported to be in favour of teaching creationism in school science lessons, but later claimed his comments had been misinterpreted.
New research has been published on the dangers of a chemical widely used to line food and drink cans. Bisphenol A is being linked to an increased risk of heart disease, diabetes and liver abnormalities. Critics say it could potentially interfere with the development of a fetus. Tougher restrictions are now being called for. Dr. Ian Lang is one of the study's authors.
If someone gave you like a spoonful of it, well, you might throw up, but it wouldn't have any other consequences for your health. But what is important is when you're exposed to very low doses, tiny doses of it over a very long period. And we think that that's where the problems arise, when people are exposed to this chemical, which is all around us.
Doctors say children under 18 should be banned from using sunbeds following a major review into the links with skin cancer. They have found clear evidence ultraviolet radiation, or prolonged exposure to sunlight in childhood, raises the risk of developing skin cancer later in life. The researchers say a ban on under-18s using sunbeds should be accompanied by a clampdown on advertising campaigns that claim they are safe to use.
And collapsing fish stocks in the North Sea is leading to infanticide in guillemots. The birds have begun killing their neighbours' chicks by pecking them to death and pushing them off cliff edges. Experts say the unprecedented breakdown in the social behaviour could eventually see the whole colony die out. Biologists at the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology near Edinburgh have been monitoring a colony of 20,000 guillemots on the Isle of May since 1983. There's been a long-term decline in the weight of the adults and the number of chicks they raise each year. In 2005, they noticed food had become so scarce that both parents were forced to hunt for food at the same time, leaving their chicks to fend for themselves.
Chuckle one and chuckle two, thank you very much. James, creationism, this Michael Rice story, it's a bit of a complex one. Take us through exactly what happened.
Michael Rice was talking in a debate on this issue and he gave an interview to journalists on it. He also wrote a kind of more detailed exposition of his position on the science blog. And, you know, we also got an audio interview with him.
Creationism is not science. And it should not be given equal time in science lessons, and it shouldn't be presented by science teachers as a scientifically valid alternative. But as a teacher, I'm comfortable when dealing in science lessons with what students bring to the lesson, even if it isn't good science.
What then happened was all the papers wrote about it, and some of the subtlety of that message was lost, I think. And although, you know, very often, you know, the context of what he was saying was in those stories, you know, towards the top, it was kind of lead scientist says teach creationism. And it appears that the Royal Society and some of its eminent fellows only read the top of those stories and thought he was suggesting something that he wasn't. And as a result, there were sort of calls for him to go from people like Harry Croteau, Sir Harry Croteau, and The result was that he left, and it's not entirely clear whether he was pushed or he jumped, but I suspect it was a combination of both. And, you know, the weird thing is that he's written about this before in a book chapter and laid out his position before, so the Royal Society knew exactly where he was coming from. I suspect that some of those people hate the idea of anything about creationism being even mentioned in a science lesson, and that's maybe why they wanted him to go.
They're clearly very protective of their image. Matt, what do you think? Did the Royal Society lose its nerve a bit?
Yeah, well, I've got absolutely great sympathies for him. You know, his position is very similar to my position on this. I do actually use some creationist material in my lectures and give it to students as a practical to discuss. And I think it's very useful. And he's obviously just been misquoted, and the Royal Society should have really just ignored it, I think.
All right, well, let's move on from that to the bisphenol A story. This is a bisphenol A, no one's ever thought that it was very safe, but now it's linked to heart disease and diabetes.
Yeah, the work before suggesting that there might be a problem here has been mainly on animals, suggesting that it's a hormone mimic, that it, you know, the body treats it a bit like estrogen and can lead to hormonal consequences. You know, that affect your physiology and may have consequences for health. This study is going a bit further, but it's not, you know, kind of conclusive, really, in that it's very difficult to do the sort of study that you'd want to do. But nonetheless, this was nearly 1,500 adults looking at bisphenol A levels in their urine as a marker of how much they have in their body. And those people with heart disease and various other conditions were more likely to have a higher level in their, or, you know, tended to have a higher level in their urine. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that one is causing the other. It's only an association, but it's quite a big study, and it's more evidence suggesting that there might be a problem. And bisphenol A, incidentally, is from packaging materials like sort of hard, clear plastic that you often get on water bottles and baby feeding bottles, hard plastic that you get sometimes toys made out of, that sort of thing.
I'm Robert Winston. I'm Professor of Science and Society at Imperial College and new chair, and this is the Guardian podcast.
The music industry will be hoping for silent seas over the next month. This week, an expedition departs for the west coast of Greenland. On board will be a list of performers Glastonbury will be proud of: Jarvis Cocker, Katie Tunstall and Martha Wainwright, as well as composers, architects, poets, film directors and even a beatboxer, will be taken to a place where many believe the evidence of climate change is clearest. There are a couple of oceanographers and geoscientists on board too, so they all know what they're doing, and a captain as well, hopefully. It's being run by Cape Farewell. We've been speaking to Katie, real name Kate, as well as the organisation's director, David Buckland.
Cape Farewell is, I suppose, is an umbrella of the best creative talent we can find globally, embedded with the scientific community, and then we are looking at climate change. And at the end of the day, and you know, scientists have done such a brilliant job in saying, wait a minute, there's a serious problem here. You know, it's our lives, the way we live our lives, that is actually causing the problem of climate change. So therefore, in a way, it's a cultural challenge, not a scientific challenge. You know, how do you manufacture a cultural change? And if you look back in history, then actually the things when society moves quickest, they're not political or economic. They tend to be cultural shifts. You know, the 60s was the obvious one recently. And there have been some good examples and really horrible examples like Nazism in Germany. So, you know, to try and achieve a cultural shift, which I think is necessary in order to embrace climate change, is how do you go about doing it? And that was our challenge. And then you have, you know, if you have people like Kate coming up and all of the other artists that, you know, the 31 that have been up with us so far and joined by 40 this year, you know, you just suddenly be delivering a creative mass, a creative change of teasing maybe what can happen into the future.
To sit in my flat in Harlesden and read the fantastic Guardian website about, you know, and just read the information, or even stand here and talk to David and be really inspired and excited and terrified about what's going on, or, you know, meet Rajendra K. Pachauri, the head of the IPCC, and really know, you know, get the facts. It's just not the same as taking yourself and your soul to that landscape and to that area and to see it. And that's when it becomes real. And I think that the, you know, the horrible kind of, you know, big issue anthems that really piss you off often just come from kind of couch preaching. And I think that when you do go somewhere like that, it might affect me as an artist in a way I really didn't expect. And I might write something really weird or really, you know, immediately not, doesn't sound related, but it's come from that. And I think that that's where the integrity comes from, is actually having the experience of seeing something firsthand.
Do you worry that the whole thing might be dismissed as some kind of publicity stunt? You know, you're sending a bunch of celebrities over to the Arctic. When David Cameron did the same thing and, you know, went sledding with the Huskies, people just said, well, it's just, you know, PR.
Well, I think, like, towards anything to do with climate change, it's going to be mixed. You're going to have your full tilt dissenters saying that it's just a huge PR stunt. All the artists going are just doing it because they want to get coverage, and they can fuck off because you just can't care. There's no time to pander to the negativity. And I don't even know how to say it, because I don't want to dismiss logical argument, because, you know, there's definitely this worry that climate change is turning into some sort of new religion where everybody wants something to kick against. They can all get together and you don't have to have any sort of dogma and Bible involved. And that's easy for us atheists to get involved in. So it's important that we listen to criticism and that we learn about the questions that people have against the advice that we've been given or the research that's being done. But all you need to do is read and learn and listen. And I've tried to be as balanced as I can. And every single time, the information and the people who are telling me that this is a really serious problem always win. The negative sort of non-believers of climate change, if you like, always sound like incredibly jaded, very negative people. I just don't, even on a personal level in my life, don't have time for people like that.
Our reporter Imran Khan there, speaking to Katie Tunstall and David Buckland. Matt, you've been to the poles. What kind of advice can you give to these artists about surviving up there?
Yeah, well, I've been to the Antarctic a few months, camping on the ice in the Antarctic. So my advice, take your woolly underwear and eat as much as you can in the field. You're allowed to eat. In the Antarctic, you eat about 4,000 calories a day, mostly in chocolate. Katie, enjoy yourself.
And what about the experience? She was saying there that, you know, she might be affected in ways that she doesn't know. How did it affect you as a scientist to go down to the Antarctic?
As a scientist, it was a bit of fun, actually. Well, they give you a skidoo that does 60 miles an hour across the ice. Of course it's fun. It's one of the most unusual and breathtaking places on Earth. And there is nothing like sitting outside my tent for hours in a blizzard at minus 70. It's great.
I can't imagine that's warm. You can follow the progress of the expedition at capefarewell.com. Plenty of activity on the blogs this week. Many of the posts from the BA Festival of Science still getting you talking. Let's look at a couple of topics on pretty similar themes. Robert Winson's Science Delusion, where he respectfully criticised Richard Dawkins' dismissive approach to the creationist debate. Again, a few carefully vetted comments here. I would prefer not to, said. Winston is bang on target here. I'm a lifelong atheist, but Dawkins' approach to religion is just thick. He just doesn't get it.
Monkey Speaks says, I can't believe that Richard Dawkins is getting such a hard time from celebrity scientists and religious icons. Dawkins published The Selfish Gene in 1976 and devoted many years of his life to popularising the theory of evolution. In a post-9/11 world where religious rights have been given a free run in the media, it seems as though science has been caught in the crosshairs. Is it any wonder that Dawkins should wish to defend his discipline from the persistent and increasingly provocative attacks of the religious right?
Let's look at a few of the posts on the Michael Rice creationist round now. Mumbo Jumbo asks, what should science teachers do when faced with students who are creationists? Simply inform them that they are entitled to their own private beliefs, but that unsubstantiated belief has no place in science and it's not an alternative explanation. By all means, adopt a critical approach, but it would be a great disservice to our children to give them the impression that if you don't like the implications of some scientific explanations, you can discard them and replace them with a story of your own. We need to set a limit to infinite error.
Sack of Stones added, thank you for that, Michael Rice. I agree wholeheartedly. Creationism is not a scientific theory, but since it still has its adherents and challenges scientific theory, it's an appropriate subject for a science lesson. I regard the Bible as a snapshot of a moment in the evolution of human mythology.
And a blogger whose name I'm not going to be able to pronounce without making it sound rude. Why stop at creationism, says Fukuyar? Why not include the world being flat with the soul revolving around it?
And Lucy Q would happily support the kiddies bringing Harry Potter books to class and making magic wands too.
Do me a little favour and have your say on the blog, of course, or you can also talk on our Facebook wall.
Science Weekly.
Every week there's news that a new car does something environmentally friendly, whether it runs on biofuels or electricity or hydrogen. But a small British company, Axon Automotive, has come up with a prototype eco car that does things a bit differently. Instead of running on exotic fuels, it runs on normal petrol, and its makers claim it can do 100 miles per gallon. I'm here with the Axon car. Now, this is a vivid orange two-seater. Its makers claim it can do 100 miles to the gallon. It runs on petrol. And it can do that because it's made of carbon fibre. The body and the chassis are all made of this very super lightweight material. Inside, the prototype is not very well kitted out. You can still see the joins everywhere, but you can get a sense of space. It's probably about the size of a smart car, probably a little bit less than that. There's a sort of big enough boot. It's two big suitcases probably and a couple of weekend bags in there. There's the obligatory sat-nav and, bizarrely, a leather dashboard. The seats look like they're made of recycled pinstripe suits and comfortable enough. Now, let's speak to the designer of the car.
Hello, I'm Steve Cousins, Managing Director of Axon Automotive. We have a technology for making the chassis, out the beams of the chassis, out of carbon fibre. This is a unique technology which is patented around the world. And this enabled us to make to get into the car market and make cars affordably. Steel cars cost a very huge amount of money to manufacture in the first place. The tooling is very expensive. Tooling for carbon fibre is very cheap by comparison, a factor of 100 times cheaper. And it's because of that that we're able to bring this technology into the market and deliver very low CO2 emissions.
When people think of eco cars, we're normally thinking of something that runs on grass or electricity. Why have you gone down the petrol route?
I think we all want to reduce the amount of petrol consumed. And the best way of reducing petrol is to use, for all cars, to use half as much. And that's our approach. The unique thing about our technology, you really have to compare it to a tree. All the other people make sheets, so it's all the outside of the car, the leaves. We make the beams. We make the branches and the trunk.
Interesting analogy. Who's going to buy this car, do you think?
We've done a lot of market research, and two-seat cars are really bought by, you know, young people, or as a second car for families, or the elderly people, or people whose children have left home. So it's a very broad spectrum of people, and also the government has to buy 10% of its vehicles as green vehicles. Corporates are also looking to lower their carbon footprint. So it's a very, very diverse range of markets.
When you get this into market, in how many years, are you expecting it to be at the higher end of the sort of scale of like a three-door hatchback or something, or is it going to be just as cheap as anything else?
We've got a price target of $10,500 for the car. But if you wanted to buy the prototype, we'd sell you that for $650,000.
How much does it cost to research all of this then?
Well, a bit more than that, actually, about $800,000.
And you're looking now in your company for money to go to the next stage. What is that?
We're here at the Cambridge Enterprise Conference to try and raise $4 million to put alongside the $2.7 million that we already have to productionise this car.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Before we finish the show this week, Matt, let's just come back to you. We've talked about the serious science of meteorites and kind of the dust and where it comes from, what it tells us about the solar system. Now let's move on to something that most of our listeners probably want to know from a meteorite specialist. You know, how are we going to stop a massive meteorite from slamming into the Earth and destroying us?
Well, it's actually quite easy.
I'm glad.
It is quite easy because these things are in space. So if you have a 1 kilometre diameter asteroid that weighs about 1 billion tonnes. Now, normally it's quite difficult to move 1 billion tonnes, at least on Earth. But luckily in space, once you start something moving, it just keeps on moving. There's no friction. So to make an asteroid miss the Earth, we've got to move it by about 7,000 kilometres, roughly the radius of the Earth.
And if you've got 10, 20 years to do that, you've only got to make it move at a few centimetres per second to do it. And we can do that with current day technology and current day rockets.
Now, there's been some weird and wacky ways described in our newspaper and in journals and all sorts of places about how you might deflect asteroids. Things like gravity tractors. It's this idea that you have something which sits next to an asteroid for a few years and by the force of gravity nudges it, as you say, a few centimetres every day or whatever. And then there's all sorts of other things like firing lasers at asteroids to burn off a little bit of them so they go off into different directions. I mean, how fantastical are these things? And genuinely, if something was headed towards us, how confident are you that we'd be able to move it out of the way?
Let's face it, if my plumbing goes wrong, then I would call a plumber who would deal with it the way that plumbers always have, you know, he'd get his socket wrenches out. I wouldn't get some fantastic new device that hadn't been tested on anything to fix my plumbing. And it's the same with asteroids. You know, we're going to use the technology we are good at. And what we're good at is making rockets. Well, not us, the Russians and the Americans.
And so you'd fire a rocket at the asteroid in the hope that it would explode it.
We would either use what's known as a kinetic impactor, which is to fire a rocket directly at the asteroid and it's just changing momentum. Or we would attach those rockets to the asteroid, and that's probably the safest way of doing it.
Now, the European Space Agency has this quite ambitious plan called Don Quixote. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It's a mission that is going to test this deflection technique. It's going to use one of these kinetic impactors. It's actually going to drop a small probe, fire a small probe at the asteroid, and that's going to make the asteroid move a little bit. And then it's going to measure that movement. It will only be a few millimetres per second. And obviously they're going to be very, very careful about the way that they do this.
So lots of deflected
towards the Earth. You know, there have been certainly science fiction writers who've talked about using asteroids as weapons. In fact, I think didn't Ming the Merciless fire asteroids at the Earth?
Is that right?
I think so, yeah. You know, you could do it.
Flash Gordon had to save them in 24 hours, yeah.
Yeah, there'd be a lot better weapons you could use than asteroids, I think.
On that positive note, we'll leave it there. Thanks for that this week. My thanks to James as well as geologist Matt Genge. On next week's show, we put James behind bars, and it's all in the name of ecology and crimes against podcasting. Science Weekly was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha, and I'm now off, apparently, to ride a black horse under a cherry tree. Woohoo!